introduction. And I want to start actually but with one other disclaimer. So Mrs. Katz, when you emailed me, asked me if I would give this year on this topic, you said that the Neely and the Kollel is giving a series of classes related to topics that come up in Shtisel. So you wrote in your email that I don't know if you're if I'm as familiar with as Rabbi Brand is with the various topics, but surrogacy is one of the things that comes up, and Rabbi Brand said that I'm an expert in the topic, medical halachic topic of surrogacy. So I just have to clarify. I probably know more about Shtisel than Rabbi Brand, and Rabbi Brand certainly knows a lot more about the medical halacha of surrogacy than I do. But I do also find it to be an amazingly interesting topic and relevant topic, and one that I have done a lot of research on and looked into. So I want to share a lot of that with you, medical backgrounds on the medical issues and the halacha that comes out of it. What's especially fascinating is that this is something that is completely new to Torah and to halacha in terms of modern questions. And it's fascinating to see how contemporary poskim look at our ancient Torah, our sources, to find relevant material in order to understand what direction to take in these cases. So let me start with sharing the PowerPoint, and we'll go back and forth between the PowerPoint and discussing some of the topics. So the discussion would have been a little bit more, I guess, timely if we were a few weeks ago, right after Mother's Day, when we really have to figure out where to send those Mother's Day cards, especially as we'll see through some of these cases that the halachic situations can get a little bit complicated in figuring out who exactly the halachic mother actually is. So I'd like to go through cases, a few cases, to kind of set the table for how we're going to review the halacha and the medical situation. So the case number one is the case of gestational surrogacy. If you are not familiar with the Netflix show Shtisel, this is not a spoiler, but everything you need to know will be on this slide. So Mrs. Ruchami Tonic, she's not, I was pointing, she's not Shtisel, she's a grandchild of Shtisel, but her last name is Tonic. She was diagnosed with pulmonary arterial hypertension during her first pregnancy. This resulted in dangerously elevated blood pressure and a high risk of heart failure and mortality. Her first pregnancy ended at 22 weeks with the ultimate loss of the baby after heroic efforts were unsuccessful. Although she desperately wants a child, she cannot risk pregnancy again. So after consultation with Rav Soloveitchik, not the Rav, but the actor of Soloveitchik, she and Chanina seek a gestational surrogate. So what is a gestational surrogate? For those who are not familiar, it's basically a play, it's a formulation of regular case of in vitro fertilization or IVF. So in vitro fertilization is where an egg is harvested, an ovum is harvested from the wife, from the woman, and it is fertilized in a test tube. In this, well, this is an image, an example of how that's done. So you have an anode, which is a charged end, which will hold the egg in place, the ovum in place. A micropipette will then inject the sperm into the egg to fertilize, to create conception, to fertilize the egg. And then that is eventually, after it's allowed to develop a little further into a further stage of the zygote, it will be then reimplanted into the uterus. In the case of surrogacy, the only difference is that instead of being reimplanted into the wife, it will be implanted into another woman who is going to be the gestational surrogate, the woman who's going to hold the pregnancy to term and give birth to the baby. The arrangement is that that surrogate gives the baby back to the couple. That's the traditional situation, and we're going to the cases in the case of Shtisel was because of medical need. There's other cases where, for example, there are women who have problems with blood clotting, like an antiphospholipid syndrome, where they have multiple miscarriages, God forbid, or there are cases where the uterus itself doesn't develop properly. It could be congenital, or in the cases and situations where there may be a danger to the mother, where the uterus itself had to be removed for some reason so that woman can no longer bear the pregnancy. In another case, this is similar. So ovarian transplant would be a scenario where, for example, Mrs. P was 11 years old and she was diagnosed with leukemia and treated with high-dose chemotherapy. The cancer has been cured, however, the treatment damaged her ovaries, resulting in early menopause and infertility. So now Mrs. P is 30 years old, and she's married. She's awaiting an ovarian transplant in order to restore ovarian function and fertility. So in this case, the doctors can, when the ovarian tissue is not functioning, So they can transplant another woman's either part of the ovary or the entirety of the ovary into the woman so that she can then have a normal pregnancy after that. This can also be done as with that. That's called an allograft, but you can also have what's called an autograft, which is also much more common in cases, God forbid, where a woman has to undergo a chemotherapy. They can take, before the chemotherapy is administered, they can remove a portion of the ovary, freeze it, store it for later, and it can be reimplanted back into the same woman where you don't have problems of different genetics, you don't have any issues in terms of rejection, and that same ovarian tissue is available after the cancer hopefully is in remission for the woman to regain fertility and ovarian function. And the third situation would be a case where a couple is seeking an egg donation, an ovum donation. And that is, for example, where in the case here, Mr. and Mrs. W have been married for 8 years. Multiple attempts to IVF have been unsuccessful. Mrs. W's ovaries are anatomically difficult to access. Now, what that means is that in order to extract the egg from the ovary, it's not an open surgical procedure. It's a minimally invasive ultrasound-guided removal of the egg. And how that's performed is, this is an ultrasound image from such a procedure. The women's ovaries are hyperstimulated, so it produces a lot of follicles. Each follicle containing this black, dark fluid on the ultrasound contains a tiny egg. And the ultrasound will guide a needle, minimally invasive, into the follicle, where there's suction on the other side, which will extract the fluid. They'll be able to analyze the fluid for multiple follicle extractions afterwards, and hopefully they were able to harvest the number of eggs from that procedure. But in order to be able to do that, this is not an open surgical procedure. This is being done through ultrasound guidance minimally invasively. The ovaries have to anatomically be located in a portion of the pelvis which is accessible through this procedure. Sometimes it's not so accessible, and that is a situation where they cannot harvest the ovary the eggs through that procedure. The couple, like in this case, would seek an egg donation. This would also be an option in cases where there are DNA genetic diseases which might be coming from the woman, and in order to get, not have the problematic DNA transferred to the child, they will instead seek a egg donor in order to provide that genetic material. So again, this is the background cases. We're going to discuss the cases of egg donation, cases of surrogacy, and of ovary donation. Now, the truth is that the medical history of this entire story comes actually back into 1906 from a case report that was published in New York in a medical journal, medical record, by a Dr. Robert Morris of New York. Dr. Morris had reported the case of a patient of his who in 1902 had ovarian failure. And they removed this patient, her name is reported here as Mrs. H.W. They removed her ovaries, which were found to be, they say, sclerotic. They were sclerotic, they were not functional. And he, at that time, in 1902, transplanted back into the woman, another woman, in this case called Mrs. P in the story, her ovary. So they transplanted from another woman into the one who had the ovarian failure, another woman's ovary. 4 years later, when this report is being published, Dr. Morris is describing that this woman, who was the recipient of an ovarian transplant, successfully had a pregnancy and delivered a healthy baby. This case report, which sounded sensational, probably honestly never happened, because for at least another 100 years, no other case reports of successful ovarian transplant, let alone successful ovarian transplant leading to a pregnancy, where the woman was actually able to deliver a healthy baby, this didn't even occur another time until the early 21st century. So this is a case that was reported. They didn't even know what DNA was at this time. They certainly didn't know anything about HLA compatibility between donors and recipients. They didn't have anything. They didn't know anything about immunosuppression, which is often necessary in these cases to prevent rejection of the transplant material. But nonetheless, this is what's reported in New York in 1906. So it didn't take a long time for it to get around the medical world. And in that, later on in 1906, there is a meeting in England of the Edinburgh Obstetrical Society. And they had their on their docket of discussions, the doctors included the discussion of this case of Dr. Morris, called the case of heteroplastic ovarian grafting, followed by pregnancy and a living child. And in the red underline, the question they wanted to know, which is one of the questions that the halachic world wants to know, is query, who is the mother? Is it the woman who donated the material, or is it the woman who is the one who has the pregnancy? So they record the different doctors' discussions, and one of them is Dr. Michael DeWar. And he is reported here as considering the question to be difficult to answer, which indeed it is. And he says that he believes that the ovums in the underline on the top, the ovum certainly came from the second woman, and consequently the child was hers. So he would say that the genetic mother, the woman who supplied the ovary, is the legal mother in their eyes, or the medical mother in their eyes. Another opinion comes from Dr. James Ritchie, who says that he believes that in the view of the recorded cases in which pregnancy had occurred, so he says that assuming that the ovary, know that this baby comes from the transplanted ovary and that there was nothing left over, he believes that it no longer belonged to the woman who supplied the transplant, but had become an integral part and underline of the woman who bore the child. And therefore, in his opinion of the speaker, the child belongs to the woman who bore it. In other words, we would say in halacha that it was batel to the recipient. The ovary was batel to the recipient, so that the recipient, the woman who gave birth, the birth mother in this case, would be the legal mother. So of course, from the medical world, the halachic world is not too far behind. And the next source I want to share with you is a halachic journal. And this halachic journal is similar to, this comes from Europe, in Eastern Europe. This is actually a collection of halachic discussions at the, again, early 20th century. Similar to like the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, or Tehumen in Hebrew in Israel, where he publishes various halachic discussions that were happening in the Jewish world at the time. This particular journal discussion is published by Yosef HaKohen Schwartz in Bonihad, Ungarn, in the year 5668, or Tafresh Samaches, which is 1908. So in 1908, the halachic world finally discusses the case of the medical world was discussing, but they got the case a little bit wrong, as we'll see. And let me step out of the PowerPoint for a minute, and I'm going to read to you the discussion. It's hard to read on the PowerPoint, and I'll share with you. So what he gets a letter, which he publishes, this Rabbi Schwartz, from a Rabbi Gordon from Southport, England. And Rabbi Gordon writes to him, he says, I want to present to the halachic world a question. He says, Harofim himsiu po tachbula lehoshiv klei leidam isha v'isha akara. So he got the case a little bit, the details a little bit mixed up. They thought that the entire reproductive organ system was transplanted from one woman into the other. And so therefore, what he's asking is, okay, so the one woman, the mother, is donating all the uterus, the ovaries, all the reproductive organs to the second woman who's barren. And for that, she's able to conceive. He says, I can't believe this actually happened, but assuming that it's permitted, he wants to know, would the child, if it's a boy who's born, would that child be a bechor? Because here we have a uterus that was transplanted from the mother. We had a child already. That uterus already birthed the child. And now it's transplanted into a woman who was barren, never had a child before, and now has a boy. Do we consider that boy to be a bechor? Because for this mother that he bore him, never had a child before. But from the uterus perspective, that uterus already had a child. So is it a bechor? And he also asks, Bechlal mihiaim, who's the mother? Is it the first woman who donated the material? Or is it the recipient, the birth mother? So he says, I have some ideas, but he said, I'd be really scared to say it on my own what the answer would be. So I'm opening up the discussion. The bechor is the firstborn child, which has different halachic ramifications in terms of inheritance and in terms of being redeemed, pidyon haben, from a kohen in the right circumstance. So the question is, who's the halachic mother? Would it be a bechor if that uterus had already birthed a child in a different woman previously? So he writes, very cute, tongue-in-cheek, he writes, mi yodea peter davar, who knows the answer to the question? Peter with a saf means the answer, but also the opening. But peter with a taf means the peter, the opening of the uterus for the purposes of bechor, of firstborn. So it took a little short time later, that an answer was received and multiple answers were submitted to this question in the same journal a little later in the year 1908. And this answer, which I'll read to you, comes from Rav Binyamin Aryeh HaKohen Weiss, I think not related to Lippi Weiss. And he writes the following. He says, I can't believe this even happened. I can't believe it's even possible. And in fact, he's probably right. It never really happened at that time, probably. And certainly it didn't happen that the entire reproductive organs were transplanted, but that's what he thought happened. And he asks the same questions, and he suggests that the answer might come from a Gemara in Sota. And let me share that Gemara with you now, going back to the PowerPoint. The Gemara says that if you have a tree, which is a young sapling, now the laws are of Orla, that for the first 3 years that a fruit tree produces fruit, its fruit is forbidden for consumption, which is called Orla. After 3 years, the fourth year's fruit is eaten in Yerushalayim, called Netzer Revai, and subsequently the fruit is permitted for consumption anywhere. But for the first 3 years, it's prohibited to eat the sapling. What if we take from this tree and we transplant it, we graft it, an older tree? So that's the case that the Gemara talks about, which is Yalda Shesivcha Bezikna. We take that young sapling branch and graft it onto the older tree. Now, the branch, which is from the sapling, produces fruit. Do we say that that fruit is going to be prohibited because it comes from the sapling, or is permissible because it is grafted onto the trunk of an older tree? So the Gemara says, and the law is, that it is Batel Yalda Bezikna. The young sapling is negated by the older tree, the Ein Ba Din Orla. And the laws of prohibited Orla do not apply to this branch, this grafted branch, and the fruit that is produced from it. And the same, by the way, is true in the reverse. So if we transplant an older branch from an older tree onto a young sapling, and then that older branch produces fruit, the fruit will be prohibited because of Orla, the first 3 years of that tree, just like the tree it is grafted to, even though the branch might come from an older tree. So what you see from here, he suggests in the Vilaki Yosef, that we follow the source of where the tree comes from. We follow where it's grafted to, so that similarly an organ that is transplanted from the first woman into a second woman, the second woman, it becomes part of her body, and that that organ, if it produces a child through that uterus, it is like it's part of the new woman. And therefore, it's like the uterus starts from scratch. So therefore, a child born out of that uterus will be a firstborn, a bechor, even though that uterus may have come from a different woman initially who had children previously. And the same is true potentially for the ovary. Now, why is this relevant in halacha? So this is relevant in halacha because similarly, Rav Zvi Yehuda Waldenberg was a preeminent posek from the second half of the 20th century. He was nifter in 2006, but for many years he was the posek of Shari Tzedek Hospital in Yerushalayim. And he suggests, based on this concept, where you put something new tissue material from one woman A to woman B, that becomes batel, negated, and becomes subsumed into the host, the recipient. Then the same he would suggest would apply to a surrogate mother, where the baby, the fetus, is produced in a test tube through IVF, and then that tissue is embedded into the uterus of the surrogate, that the surrogate becomes the mother of that child based on the same concept of batel, of the transplanting of the organ or grafting of the taste of the tree. Others suggest that that's not a great proof because there may be a very big difference between transplanting an organ, which does not have its own life force, does not have its own halachic standing even, than transplanting a fetus. And the question is, and there's a question in halacha in the concept of whether a fetus, while it's in the uterus, is it considered to be part of the mother, like just one of her organs, part of her tissues until it separates at birth, or is it itself a separate life form? And therefore would not be considered batel. So that is one of the initial proofs that is discussed in terms of surrogacy, and would try and prove from there that the birth mother, the recipient, the surrogate mother, is the halachic mother, based on that concept alone. Now, I think I just want to step back for a second and tell you a story. This discussion that we're having about the transplanted uterus and the ovaries, it never happened, and probably never happened in 1906. It didn't happen for another 100 years. When I was initially researching this, I was a resident in 2008. I was going through these halachic discussions because just before that, as I'll show you soon, there was the first case of a transplanted ovary leading to a successful pregnancy. But a uterus transplant, which is the actual case, which relates to the firstborn questions, and who's the halachic mother, which was discussed in the halachic world, that actually didn't even happen when I first started researching this in 2008. It was also science fiction in that time. Now, fast forward to 2014. I'm attending now in the Cleveland Clinic in Florida, and we had just started in our hospital a transplant program. We were starting to do liver and kidney transplants. And the transplant surgeon at the time who was leading the program was a Dr. Andres Tzatzakis. Called me to his office one day, wanted to review some images for one of his patients. As I'm leaving his office, I walk out by his door. He's got a framed picture of a baby, looks like it just came out of a cesarean section on the wall, with all these doctors' hands and gloves signing their names on the picture. And I said, Dr. Zakis, why do you have a liver and kidney transplant surgeon? Why do you have a picture of a baby on your wall? What is this? So he said, obviously, this is incredible. This picture just happened a few months ago. This picture is the picture of the very first baby ever born to a liver transplant, to a uterus transplant. And I got the goosebumps. Not because of the medical advance, which is incredible in and of itself, but I was looking at the Vilaket Yosef, the halachic discussion that took place over 100 years ago. I was looking at that bare relevance in front of me. And actually, since 2014, there's been a number of additional pregnancies that have been successful after uterine transplant. So this is something that's actually happening today, which wasn't happening when I first looked into this discussion, and has the initial halachic work preceded by more than a century the medicine because of the initial case report. So I just thought it was a fascinating medical history to bring in. Okay, let me go back to the PowerPoint. This is the picture of that first baby born. And of course, the halachic discussion would be the same that was discussed in the Vilaket Yosef. Do we have any sources from the Torah where we can look to find some relevant case about where we have one mother being different between the gestational mother and the genetic mother and the birth mother? So another journal, which was published, this is in the year Tafrei Sadi Aleph, which is the year 1931, called Habe'er, also discussed the same medical case. It kept going around the Jewish world a few times. People are constantly coming up with new suggestions, new halachic insights, source material that we can use to answer the halachic question. And they, in this journal, for the first time, they quote the story and the miraculous pregnancy and birth of Dina and Yosef. And the discussion there is in the psukim we have here, but where Leah gives birth to her sixth child, but Tahar od Leah, but Taylor ben Shisha Yaakov. So she has six boys, and then she becomes pregnant again. We know that that next child is going to be Dina. The Torah says in the next pasuk, it says she then has a girl, but she calls her Dina. And here the Arei Chazal have a discussion about, well, what exactly happened? Why'd she call her Dina? Rashi already says that she's called Dina because Leah made a judgment internally. She made the following calculation. If she's pregnant, Leah realized she's pregnant, and her sister, finally, Rachel, is pregnant after waiting many, many years of being barren. And she knows that if Leah knows that if she has a seventh boy, so she has, currently has six. The two midwives, Bilhah and Zilpah, they have each two, that's 10. There's only two left. They knew that Yaakov was only going to have 12 shvatim through Ruach HaKodesh. They only were going to be 12. So if Leah, now pregnant, has boy number 7, she knows that her sister Rachel can only maximum have one boy, and she will be embarrassed that she has less than anyone else, the least of all the other wives. So she davens to Hashem that she should have a girl instead of a boy. And so the way that the Das Dikanim here understands what happened is she davens, she was at the moment, Leah was at the moment pregnant with Yosef, and Rachel was pregnant with Dina. So she davens to Hashem, Leah davens, and the two embryos, the two fetuses, somehow do a miraculous intrauterine, transuterine transfer. And what ends up happening is that Yosef ends up in the womb of Rachel, and Dina ends up in the womb of Leah. And that's what ends up happening when they give birth. And the proof that and the same is said by the Targum Yosef ben Uziel, the Chalfu Bride ben Me'on, that these fetuses switched. And the proof that they bring from the Psukim is that with all the pregnancies of Leah, it says, Vatahar, she conceived, Vatele, and then she gave birth. But in the pregnancy of Dina, it says, Va'achar Yal Dabas. It doesn't describe a conception, it only describes a delivery. And so what you see from here, they say, is that the conception did not occur in Leah, rather it occurred in Rachel. So what does this have to do with surrogacy? So a little later on in the story of Bereishis, when Yaakov comes down to Mitzrayim, you know that he comes down with 70 people, Yocheved is born between the walls, and the Torah, in the end of Sefer Bereishis, enumerates all 70 members of Yaakov's family who come down to Mitzrayim. And among them are the children of Shimon, who are listed as Yemuel, Yamin, Ohad, Yochin, Zohar, and Shaul, ben Aknanus. Who is Shaul, the son of the Canaanite? So that, Chazal say, is the daughter of Dina. And in fact, Dina, who is Shimon's sister, she marries Shimon. They get married, and she bears Shimon a child whose name is Shaul. She's called ben Aknanus. It doesn't actually list her as Dina because she was so embarrassed. What happened was she was raped by Shechem, and then she says, no one's going to marry me. She's all embarrassed, and she ends up marrying Shimon. She pleads with Shimon to marry her. But because she was, what they say what was done to her was a Canaanite type of act with Shechem, it calls this child the son of the Canaanite, not to embarrass the relationship, to hide somewhat the relationship between the brother and sister, Shimon, with his sister Dina. The Tur, Rabbi Yaakov, already asked the question 500 years ago, how is it possible that Shimon can marry his sister? Now, forget the laws of the Torah. The Torah wasn't given yet. But even a non-Jew, the seven Noahide laws, the Shiva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, a non-Jew cannot marry his sister from his mother. That's a forbidden relationship even for a non-Jew to have. So how could Shimon marry his sister? So the Torah suggests, based on what we learned in the Das Dikanim and the Targum Yosef, that there was a switch. Really, Dina was conceived genetically from Rachel, and therefore Rachel is her true mother, not Leah. So just like in the case of surrogacy, where you have a genetic mother and only subsequently a birth mother, based on this tour, based on this discussion, it would seem to conclude that the genetic mother, the conception mother, would be the halachic mother, which is what allows Shimon to marry Dina. And that is the proof from this story. Another story we're familiar with, and another proof comes from the Gemara in Megillah. We're told in the Megillah, in the actual Megillah, that Esther is an orphan and she's adopted by Mordechai. But the Megillah is repetitive. It says, Kein la'av ve'im, she had no mother or father, and it repeats, Ubimos avia ve'ima. And when her parents died, Mordechai goes ahead and adopts her. And the question is, why is the Megillah mentioned twice in the same pasuk that she's an orphan? Once is enough. So Rav Acha comes to explain in the Gemara that what the Megillah is trying to teach us is that her father died at conception at that time, and her mother died in childbirth. Rashi here on the page where I have here listed for you in bold explains the significance of this is that she never had a father or a mother even for a moment, even for a day, because Rashi explains that the father, that fatherhood is, can a person can be called father, that title halachically is given to the father at the time of conception. That's when the father's done, his job is over. So therefore, the father dying at conception meant that Esther never had a father even for a moment. But then, when her mother dies at childbirth, Rashi explains, Kishyal de ima mesa velo nires li karos aim. She could never call her mother mother. Now, if conception earlier on was a time when motherhood is defined, well, then she could have called her mother mother earlier on. But based on this Rashi, the post can prove, try to prove, that the birth process is the time at which maternity is defined, and only at that moment could Esther have called her mother mother, which is therefore, since your mother died in childbirth, she never had a mother. And this would be a proof in the other direction, that the birth mother would be the halachic mother. To step back for a second, I told you that there was these cases get complicated in medicine. This is the case report in the New England Journal of Medicine published in 2006. It's a case of twins who are genetically identical. They're identical twins, monozygotic. So their DNA is the same. However, you know, nurture versus nature. So one of the twins develops ovarian failure at a young age. Her sister, normal, has children. They take a transplant. They transplant the ovary from one twin girl into the other twin girl. And then this twin, who had ovarian failure, no ovaries that were functional, but then receives a functioning ovary from her genetic identical sister, she bears a child, has a healthy baby. Now, what's amazing about this case is number one, first of all, made easy that the two were identical because of rejection, and you didn't have normally need cases. But also, when we're talking about halachic mother and being the birth mother versus the genetic mother, here she's holding a child which comes from ovarian tissue from her sister, but is identically on the DNA level, identical to her own DNA. There's no difference between the child and the DNA in the fetus and the DNA of the mother here, even though it comes from a transplant. So this is where the halachic discussion, kind of when it comes to the actual cases, gets a little bit more complicated. And I'll get into in the end a little bit more complicated cases than this. The next proof, this is a little bit more challenging, so I'm gonna say this outside. Let me stop the share. And let me explain to this next proof. The proof here is a discussion in the Gemara of twin boys, who convert at some point in their lives. Now, after birth, when they're born, and at some point in their lives, they convert to Judaism. The halacha, the law is that when a Gentile converts to Judaism, any familial relationships, family ties that they have, that existed before the conversion, are negated. They don't count anymore. So they're not related to anybody at that stage and once they convert. And that from the time of conversion and anything prior. So these brothers, who are twins, should be related. They're twins, so we know they have the same father, they have the same mother. The halacha is, if they convert, they're no longer related. And in fact, if there's a forbidden relationship, if one were to sleep with the other one's, have relations with the other one's wife, that would normally be punished by kares, by a spiritual death. That does not apply in this case, the Gemara says, because they're no longer related through the conversion process. But if these twins are conceived by their mother when she's not Jewish, and then during the pregnancy, the mother herself converts while the babies are in utero, while they're in the fetus, while they're in the womb, she converts. When they're born, they are halachically brothers. And to the point that if one were to have relations with the other one's wife, it would be the same prohibition and the same punishment as if they were regular Jewish brothers, even though they're born to this convert. And they're related through their mother. Now, how could they be related through their mother? The conception occurred while she was not Jewish. And the conversion should render all of her relationships negated. And therefore, these brothers should not, if maternity is defined at the time of conception, these brothers should not be related. So the only thing that can put them together through their mother would have to be the birth process. So what you see from this Gemara is that if indeed these brothers are related after birth, it must be that the birth process, the birth mother, in the case of surrogacy, would be the halachic mother. And that's what binds these brothers together, and that's what creates the maternal bond in the case of surrogacy. So this Gemara, which is the Gemara in Nevamos, would be a proof for the side that says that the birth mother is the halachic mother in the cases of surrogate mother. The final proof, which I want to show you, I'm going to go back to the PowerPoint. is a discussion that sounds a bit medically complicated, but is in fact true. And it's one of these situations where when you're reading the Gemara, when you learn Torah, sometimes you're like, what is this crazy case the rabbis are talking about? Well, guess what? In this situation, this wild scenario actually teaches us something about a practical case in halacha in terms of surrogate motherhood. So the medical scenario we're talking, the Gemara is discussing, is something called the Didelphus uterus. Normally, uterus has one cavity. Sometimes the uterine cavity could be a little bit split. In this case of a Didelphus uterus, the Gemara here is talking about an animal, a cow, but it could be referring to any species, including humans. There are particular anomalies where the uterus entirely develops as two. So the woman has literally two uteri, which are either connected at the level of the cervix or at the vagina. So the entire reproductive organ is duplicated into two separate organs, A and B. So the case the Gemara discussed is if you have hitbik shnei rechamim, these two uteruses are connected, and there's a fetus that is conceived in A, and you'll call it uterus A on one side. It then, not at the end of the pregnancy, but somewhere in the middle, it leaves that uterus. It's birthed through from that uterus, but it doesn't go all the way out of the animal. In the case the Gemara is talking about is an animal. The reason why it's discussing an animal is it wants to know. There's a just like in humans and certain Jews, when the bechor, a firstborn, is born, it has a certain level of kedusha, of holiness, that is redeemed by through the process of pidyon haben. In the case of a kosher animal, that firstborn animal also has a level of sanctity, which is normally brought as a sacrifice and given to the kohen. So the case the Gemara wants to know is what happens if this fetus leaves the first uterus. It doesn't completely leave the body of the animal, but then goes into somehow retrograde back up into uterus B, and then is born subsequently from uterus B. Do we say that uterus A is now Peterechem? It no longer will be able to have any firstborns anymore. That was the firstborn from that pregnancy. That for sure happened because that was birthed from that uterus. But do we also say that uterus B also is now no longer going to have any further firstborns? The fact that this fetus traveled from A to B and B, it birthed from B, now B also is no longer considered to be a uterus that has any other additional firstborn children. The way the Rambam understands, and the Gemara says, you don't know. It leaves it as a teiku, as a unresolved question that Eliyahu HaNavi will have to come and tell us eventually at the time of Mashiach. But the Rambam, in explaining what was exactly the Gemara's considerations, gives us a tremendous insight into what defines maternity. Because the way the Rambam says it here is, do we look at the case, the scenario, as a technical, physical manifestation? If the baby was in the uterus and it leaves that uterus, it's birthed from that uterus, well then that uterus is Peterechem. It no longer has any more firstborn children. That is its firstborn. Or do we define the firstborn relationship with the mother or the uterus as being, as the Rambam describes, as Ad Sheyiftor, in the underlying section here, Yiftor Rachma Vlada, until that uterus, that rechem, births its child. Not any child, not any material, not any tissue, but specifically its child. Well, what the, in this case, it's not its child, because this fetus was conceived in uterus A. So the Rambam understands that the definition of what is its fetus would be, in this scenario, the first uterus. Therefore, the definition of maternity would seem to be based on conception. The time of conception occurred in uterus A, and so therefore that defines this child as being belonging to uterus A and not uterus B. And therefore, although the Gemara is not sure of how to resolve the question, do we need to have a maternal connection to this fetus or not? But at least according to the way the Rambam seems to present it, the relationship is based on the connection at the time of conception. So we just presented enough, I guess, four different sources, and there are others that are discussed among the poskim. Two of the sources we quoted seem to imply that the birth mother is the halachic mother. The surrogate then would be the halachic mother. Two of the sources we quoted would seem to imply that the genetic mother, the mother of conception, would be the halachic mother. This has important ramifications we talked about in terms of who would be the mother. It's relevant if one of the two mothers is not Jewish, should the child have to undergo conversion? If the egg donation, also same case in the reverse scenario. We talked about a scenario of a surrogate mother. We can also have a case where the egg is being donated from another woman. Would that woman's egg, because she's the mother of conception, be the halachic mother? And then finally, we also discussed what would happen in cases of ovarian transplant, and we assume in halacha that the organ that's being transplanted is subsumed by the recipient, and that that second woman, when either receiving the ovary or the uterus, would be the mother, or the, let's say, the halachic connection to the child inside, which would in fact affect who, whether the child born to a second, to a uterus that is transplanted, whether it would be a firstborn or not. And we have concluded based on this that it would be a firstborn, even though that uterus came from a woman who already had children from that uterus. Okay, that's the overall background. But just before I enter some questions, do you want to take just 2 more minutes and share with you some fascinating? So that's where medicine started maybe 20 years ago, but we're well beyond that. And I want to present to you current medical advances that take this simple question, if it's simple, of who the halachic mother is, and takes it a little bit more to a complicated level. And that's as follows. Let me share with you these new medical cases. So it can be hard, it can be challenging to find an egg donor. If a woman needs an egg donation, if a couple needs an egg donation, so it's not so simple to get an egg donor. Remember, they have to be harvested through this minimally invasive procedure to get the egg from the woman who's hyperstimulated. Even the hyperstimulation process has risk factors. So is there another source that they can find for an egg donor? And this is medically possible, but ethically not been allowed to date that we're aware of. Unlike a baby boy, a baby girl is born with all of her eggs already present at the time of birth. They simply go a maturation process during puberty, but they're already present in the fetus, in the baby, in the fetus's ovaries. So if, God forbid, there is a late-term abortion or a late-term fetal demise, chas v'shalom, now you have a baby that has pretty much developed ovaries that have in them all the eggs that child would ever have had, just underdeveloped, which can be in a test tube, matured with the right hormones, and then can be used for as an egg in IVF. So the question I ask you halachically is, could, if we say that the genetic mother is the halachic mother, is it possible to have a halachic mother who never even lived? Here it's a fetus who's providing the ovary, the ovum and the egg, who never even lived. Potentially, it could be from the same couple who has a problem conceiving. There's a late fetal demise, and they want to use that unfortunate situation for something good. Can they take the egg and then use that in IVF in another round? Would that mean that this child who's born is a mother to a sister? Crazy. That's one case that has to be worked out halachically if ever were to come to be. It has advantages. Ethical issues have to be figured out, but it has medical advantages because it doesn't require another woman undergoing a invasive procedure to collect her ovaries, eggs. Can you have 3 genetic parents? So we all know that in the nucleus, there's 46 chromosomes, 23 come from the mother, 23 come from the father, but there's another set of DNA, not RNA. We've talked a lot about RNA viruses, RNA vaccines, but there's DNA elsewhere in the cell. And the DNA elsewhere in the cell, outside the nucleus, is in what's called the mitochondria, which you might remember from cell biology many years ago. The mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. It actually contains its own set of separate DNA. And there are diseases that can exist just from the mitochondrial DNA. A person receives their mitochondrial DNA only from their mother. Remember, the father is providing genetic material to the nucleus. But in the egg, the cytoplasm, everything outside the nucleus, has the mitochondria that will be for that developing fetus only from the mother. If that mother has mitochondrial DNA with a genetic defect, what they can do is remove the nucleus from the couple's fertilized egg, take that nucleus, all good DNA, discard the mitochondria that is diseased, take a donor egg from another woman who has DNA mitochondria that's has no genetic defects, remove the nucleus from that separate woman's egg, and implant the fertilized nucleus into that other woman's egg. So you have now you have a fetus that comes from the nuclear DNA from two people, from the mother and the father, and the mitochondrial DNA from a third woman. So would we say if the genetic mother is the halachic mother, then now a person has two halachic mothers, 1.5 halachic mothers, a certain percentage of mitochondrial DNA halachic mother? How would halacha address that situation? And this is also, again, medically possible even today. The final medical advance in understanding surrogacy actually is very recent, within the last 6 or 7 years. It's something called epigenetics. Now, we know that genetics refers to DNA, but as we know, there's nurture and nature. Even twins don't always end up, identical twins don't always end up the same. So there's something that happens to the DNA which causes its expression to become the right proteins to be a little bit different. And that's the environment it's in, but it's also due to what's called DNA methylation. Additional molecules can be added onto that DNA, not the DNA code itself, but onto it, onto proteins called histones, which affect how the DNA is read by the body and how the proteins it develops are made. So what they have found in the last number of years is that there actually is a transfer of cells through the placenta between the fetus and the surrogate mother, who have no genetic relationship, but there are cells that go from the fetus and embed themselves in certain tissues, stem cells. Now that's how they seem to think that might be helpful, because it embeds in, for example, a cesarean scar, it might embed in the heart tissue, which helps the mother, whether it be a surrogate or a regular, you know, regular case of mother of a pregnancy, helps the woman to heal, to have the stem cells are helpful as they come from the fetus into the mother. There's a number of them that transfer. And there's also some transfer of cells that go from the surrogate mother into the fetus. Now, we don't know exactly what effect they have, but they suspect it might have an epigenetic effect, meaning not a direct DNA effect, but an effect on how the DNA gets expressed. And the final question they have is, can you have an epigenetic mother? So the surrogate isn't just an incubator, which is what they used to think halachically. It was the discussion between genetics and incubation. Now we see that really difference is also one of epigenetics. So even the surrogate mother has a significant impact to some extent. And again, this is in the world of research still. We haven't worked out all the details in medicine, but there's some effect that the surrogate mother has on ultimately the nurture and the genetic expression of the child. So with that, I'm going to close. And I'm happy either to take questions or if you would prefer to maybe look at the chat, whatever you would prefer. Again, with the caveat, again, this is, I think, let me just end with this one comment. Cases of surrogacy are becoming much more common in the Jewish community. I think that in general, because our community believes so strongly in having children, having many Jewish children, that couples do seek every option available to them to be able to have a child. And that I know that halachic authorities were somewhat hesitant in the 80s and the 90s, and when this first was becoming medically available. There has been more of an openness to these cases being acceptable in halacha as an option for religious families, but it needs a close connection between the medical team, the fertility specialists, and the halachic authority in the case, so whether it be local rav, or leading American halachic authorities or in Israel, to work out the best halachic details to make sure that the couple can have a child and also make sure that they're keeping to the proper halacha.
I have one question. Thank you so much, Dr. Oppenheimer. That was fascinating. I have one question that came in the chat. What would the doctors, rabbis have done with the fertilized embryos when Ruchami changed her mind?
Would they have discarded the embryos in this case? I think you were asking the question. So halacha does not consider the very early embryo at the stage that is developed for IVF, which is it's called a blastosphere. It's like an 8-cell organism at that point, to be a halachic person. And so my understanding is that until even later in terms of pregnancy, there are certain situations for which we will distinguish between very, very early stage pregnancy and later stage pregnancy for questions that come up related to needs of abortion or other considerations. But in the case here, where embryos are developed in this test tube, at such an early stage, halacha does not give it significance as a person. I believe that other religions might. I'm not an expert in those, but in halacha, the very early stage cells do not have the significance of a religious being, of a neshama at that stage.
I see that there's one more question in the chat. Is the success rate less or more than with regular IVF?
For cases of surrogacy? It's a good question. I don't know what the current numbers are. The medicine has gotten better. I know that with time, the success rate has gotten a lot better. In general, the quoted success rate for IVF is for, let's say, implanting one embryo is about a third of a chance, 33% chance, which is why sometimes they will try and implant more than one fetus, because if you have a 33% chance for each implantation, if you implant three, you in theory have a 100% chance that at least one takes. Having triplets is a medical complication. Certainly having triplets or twins in a surrogate can really put a medical burden on that surrogate. So in general, if the cycles have been properly aligned, the simple implantation is pretty even in terms of being able to have a success rate for IVF. There isn't the same genetic complications that they have because there is mostly a complete separation, and they do check for certain blood type compatibilities that they do with every pregnancy. So those are the main considerations that have to be checked. But otherwise, the success rate is relatively similar, except that they will usually not implant as many embryos into a surrogate as they would to a couple who is willing to take on an additional risk of having triplets or twins in that pregnancy.
Great, thank you. And sorry, one last question and then we'll close. Is there a consensus as to who the mother is? You gave both opinions.
So that's an excellent question. And one of the things that I found incredibly fascinating, just as I looked into this halachic topic, I said about 15 years ago, I first started about 2006. At that time, or not that time, but the early halachic work initially published in the 1980s, when this first became medically viable as an option, the bias among most of the postmen was actually that the birth mother was the halachic mother. Razam Nechem Goldberg, Zatzal, he was of that opinion. They quote early, Rishon Zalman Oyerbach is quoted in Nishmas Avram is that opinion. That seemed to be the overwhelming majority of the opinions. However, like as medicine has developed, I think the postmen also have come to have a better understanding of the medicine and the genetics involved in the case. So what I have seen in more recent medical halachic literature, is that there are more poskim who are open to the idea that the genetic mother, meaning in this case, if it's a surrogate, the wife who is providing the egg to the surrogate, would be the halachic mother, the genetic mother. In this category, Rav Willig, I know some people know from Yeshiva University, and he is much strongly leans to that opinion. But the overall, there is no absolute consensus. And generally speaking, the way they treat these cases is a case of doubt. So they are stringent to handle cases of where there's a non-Jewish woman involved in terms of DNA or the surrogacy to require conversion because of the doubt that exists. So there is no consensus, but there has been somewhat of a shift halachically from probably the birth mother to maybe also the genetic mother by many other poskim, by more recent halachic discussions. And thank you very much for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to learn with you tonight. This is a fascinating area of halacha, but again, as we said, one that's very serious and sensitive to those couples who are experiencing issues of fertility. And you know, it is important to avail themselves of all the reproductive, of all the amazing things that Akash Baruch has given us. In medicine, the advances, we should take advantage of them, but do them within the confines of halacha, with seeking halacha guidance at the same time as we seek our medical experts as well. So thank you. And enjoy the rest of the series.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Dr. Oppenheimer, for joining us tonight. It was really a privilege to have you, and thank you for a truly excellent presentation. I'm sure everyone learned a lot. I know I did. Everyone, I'm posting in the chat the ways that you can follow Neely to find out not only about the next part in the series, but about all future events. So if you check out the chat, there is where you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, join our WhatsApp group, or how to join our email list. Thank you so much for joining tonight. Have a good night, everyone.
Thank you.